Poorly managed teams and agencies lead to the loss of creativity, wastage, and a lack of productivity. Jack Skills, the founder and CEO of Agency Agile, shares insights on building an agency culture that empowers teams to deliver at their highest levels.
When you actually flatten the organization and turn everyone into a creative and enable everyone to self-manage, here are the things that get better. One is client satisfaction goes up. Team satisfaction goes up. Margin goes up. Delivery velocity, how fast we deliver, goes up.
We discuss insights from his book, Unmanaged: Master the Magic of Creating Empowered and Happy Organizations. In the book, Jack shares insights of how over 200 companies have learned to manage better. I ask him how agencies can build and maintain a positive and productive culture as they grow.
So the answer is, when we get big, we have to get small again. The answer is that the 50, 60, especially the 60-person agency needs to become two 30-person agencies. We call them pods.
Right.
You need to sort of podify your organization. And in that 30-person group, you can feel that group culture again.
Keep listening to rethink how you manage your agency to ensure growth and a more engaged team. Welcome to the Lead Creative Podcast, where we talk to creative industry leaders, influencers, and brands. We discuss the strategies that influence brand thinking and shape industries. Thought leaders and heads of agencies let us in on some of their thinking and insights. I'm your host, Monge Zimtati. Enjoy the show, and please share and subscribe. Jack, thanks for making the time to talk to us on The Lead Creative. One of the things I found out about you on the internet, as the internet does, it has this long memory, is that you are a chef and a food lover.
Oh, yeah. Big time. I grew up working in restaurants, and it's one of those things that stays with you.
No, that's amazing. That's something I wouldn't have guessed given your work in, you know, as a programmer in tech, in agencies. I wouldn't have thought that. But sticking with the food analogy, right? You and your team helped hundreds of agencies rethink the ingredients of how they work, or at least how they put teams together. What do you find time and time again to be the recipe for loss of productivity in most of these instances?
I think the big challenge is that we have this idea of how to manage and what managing means. And to a degree, it's actually true. The problem is that agencies are a different type of business, fundamentally different than most businesses out there in the world. And in a sense, the things that are mostly true for how to manage in those traditional businesses actually are not true inside of agencies. And so what we see is that when an agency is very small, and you know these agencies, a 10-person agency, yeah, there's not much need to manage because it's actually quite small. But when you grow to 20, 30, 50 people, all of a sudden you do need to manage, but the wrong way of managing is even worse in a way. Mm. And the sort of chaos, yeah, and craziness grows. Strangely, one is it grows because of the style of the business model that agencies have, but also it grows because of this misperception of how to manage and how much to manage.
What are some of the hindrances to the current agency model and how we manage, and how are these perpetuated over time?
You know, I think I love this podcast, because this focus of your podcast is fantastic for this question. One of the biggest problems is the whole idea of a hierarchy, a pyramid, of the idea, yeah, that we have manager managing people, and then when I become promoted there, I'm a director managing managers, and eventually a vice president or an executive creative director managing creative directors. This pyramid is actually very toxic to agencies. In agency, what you really want is you want for everyone to get to the top. And the pyramid means that you've got your people fighting each other to get to the top. And while there is a winner every time a promotion happens, there are a bunch of losers. And there's really no need for it. that structure, again, it was something used in traditional businesses. It was a convenience back 100 years ago, but it's certainly not a necessity. And agencies that actually sort of flatten themselves in that way and say, let's not build so much hierarchy, they run a lot better. Because the creation of managers actually decreases productivity in an organization.
So then how do we decrease this? How do we flatten the structure? Because in as much as a lot of the time agencies and companies would say, we have a flat structure, there are certain people, there's the person who talks to the client, and there's the person where if ideas are good enough, they present those ideas to the client. And part of it is hierarchical. Sometimes it isn't, but part of it is hierarchical. So how do we flatten the structure so that actual creativity thrives rather than hierarchy?
You know, I've been on about 20 podcasts since we launched the book last year, and no one has ever asked me that question. It's a great question, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
If we think about how does managing manifest, in other words, if we say we're managing and we have managers, what day-to-day, how does it manifest? And it manifests mostly through actions. And the thing, what we want to look at, when we're saying, if we truly flatten the organization, what we're doing is we're decreasing the amount of manager-only actions. In other words, we're saying that everyone can become a manager. Everyone can be self-managing. We can, and how do we create self-managing? We create that by stepping back, leaning back as managers, and allowing people to step up and self-manage. Like you say, I love your example. It is the person who is, hey, I've got this killer idea. I'm going to just go ahead and work up a comp for it or prototype something real quick. And I'm going to make a lot of noise and push this to the top if I can. That's a self-managed individual. Now, I will claim that the more we manage, the more heavily we manage in terms of action and strength of managing and directiveness and that kind of thing, the less likely that action is on that person's part.
Yeah.
Okay. They have to feel like there's a chance of succeeding at that for them to actually undertake that thing. And if in fact it's something they love doing and they want to do and they can't do it in that environment, they will go elsewhere.
I'm getting this, and I might be getting it wrong, but I'm getting this sense that the more you manage, the more management there is, the less autonomy there is in teams. Am I getting that right?
Yeah,
because it sounds as though, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're very much spot on with it. And it's a little bit richer than that even. But I think to your point, the teams can self-manage. What most people don't realize is that teams can self-manage very, very well. And in fact, the research on it, it's very interesting, is that self-managed teams, except for in a few rare situations, self-managed teams perform as well, if not better, than managed teams. So what that says about managing is that maybe managing isn't needed all the time. And essentially, to your point, the question is, and this is why I named the book Unmanaged, okay? Because it sounds like, wow, I have an unmanaged team. How horrible is that? And in fact, it's usually a beautiful thing. It's a team that where everyone steps up and with the autonomy and the understanding of the work, they just sort of do their thing and the like. They grow and get excited about the work.
Some of the most successful agencies out there, or agencies that consider themselves to be the most successful, will say, we have a model that works. Why change it? Or why rethink it? And I think alongside that, one of the things that I find in your work and a question that has been kind of nagging me is this idea that we talk about being creative people in the creative industries, or at least in industries that are sort of thought-driven industries. I know that many industries will say that, but let's for the purpose of this example, in creative industries, we're creative in the work that we do, in the work that we deliver for clients. But in the work that in you know, researching your work and looking at your work, it looks and feels as though we are creative outwardly, but we aren't creative inward in how we do things. Is that what you're finding? And also, why change it if an agency says we feel like it's working? Why rethink it?
I think your question is also amazing in that way that it's very interesting when you think of creativity in terms of my creativity versus our creativity. And this is a leadership mindset. One of the managerial ideas, the old managerial ideas, is that we have departments that own things, like creative owns being mm-hmm. creative. And that's not really the best way to run an agency. It is a way to run an agency. It's less efficient. We've seen through the data. It's less efficient to run an agency that way. People are not as happy. The work is not as good with the clients, despite what people say. When you actually flatten the organization and turn everyone into a creative and enable everyone to self-manage, here are the things that get better. One is client satisfaction goes up. Team satisfaction goes up. Margin goes up. Delivery velocity, how fast we deliver, goes up. First time delivery quality goes up. How often we deliver it the first time the right way. All these factors go up when you actually flatten the organization and decrease the, if you will, the strictness or the strength of management.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I want to delve into that a bit later on, because this is again something that you talk about in your book. You've said in other conversations that you had that on average a 50 person marketing agency has 40 clients and manages 120 projects simultaneously. Where do they get it sort of in these teams that are able to deliver at the highest level? How do they get it right versus teams that don't?
I go into a great example of this in the book, is there's this idea that managers can manage the workload for people better than they can themselves. And this is patently not true. And one of the key techniques we teach is how do we unmanage the coordination and planning of getting the work done? And literally what we see is if we take the, you know, whatever, so 120 projects, 40 agency clients at the same time, 50 person agency, there are probably 30 to 40 work items happening that day. And if we actually set the team up, and this goes to essentially sort of old school agile techniques, but if we set the team up in the morning with a very good stand-up style meeting and teach the team how to figure out how to get it done that day, they will do it not only more efficiently than they would have if someone had directed them, but also they'll love doing it more because they were in charge of doing it. So this is these subtle differences. The key idea behind all of this is this idea of managerial exceptionalism, that because I'm a manager, there are things managers do that we do better than anyone else. And everyone has this idea, despite the fact that nobody in an agency who gets promoted to a manager has had any managerial training. All of a sudden, I put this label on this person and say they're a manager, and they somehow start behaving as if they've been anointed with a Superman cape or something like that, right? And they haven't. In fact, research shows that the best person in the department usually makes for a pretty bad manager compared to the middle people in the department.
Let's just shift a bit to culture, because that is a massive contributor, I think, company and team culture. You gave a talk entitled "Why Free Beer and Skateboards Won't Make Your Agency Culture Great." So while free beer and skateboards are really awesome at agencies, how do they create a culture that drives results and creates great impact for themselves and their clients beyond the things that we all loved about Google in its early days, and the examples that are always made about companies like that?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I live in Southern California, and being in the California community, you meet all kinds of people who work at Google, right? And there are a lot of happy Google stories, but there are the other Google stories as well. So it's easy to point to those things like free beer and skateboards. And thank you very much for, I have had multiple CEOs call that out as like the, it was a pivotal moment when they saw that webinar. And my gosh, that was like 2015 or something like that. So good job. Digging that up. The main idea here is that culture is actually a word that we need to be very careful about. A lot of times people say culture and they mean what I wish our organization had as an ethos and as a belief system. In reality, culture is very simply defined. Culture is how you behave. And in a sense, a lot of times an agency will say, we love our people and that's why we give them, you know, free beers on Thursdays and that kind of thing. And we're loving, but the real behavior is that they work everyone like dogs and that everyone's always overloaded and there's conflicting priorities and the managers are jerks. And that's the culture of the organization. Okay. How people behave. And so the real thing is, if you believe in creating a great culture, what you need to do is create great behaviors. It's not about all the research shows, it's not whether you give, those are called external, extrinsic rewards, bonuses, free beers, have your dog into the office, all that stuff. Extrinsic rewards don't change how people think about the company. They don't create lasting change. How they interact and the internal intrinsic reward of being there, the joy of working there, the interactions with people, those are the things that matter. That's what your culture is.
If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show.
How do you enable it? Because culture is such a... No, it's such a nebulous concept. You know it when you see and feel it, but it isn't something that you can go onto a drawing board and say, this is our culture. That's why we see all the things that you've just referred to, the skateboards and the beer and the, this is what we do on a Friday evening after work, but the rest of the week we'll work 12-hour days kind of situation, right? And that's it. And sometimes even doing that sort of 12-hour days when there's a big project feels better in a certain kind of company or agency because of the culture. But the 8-to-5 in a different agency feels worse, even though the culture, all the sort of plastic things are there. How do you put that in? How do you describe that? How do you introduce that? And how do you maintain that? Because in the work that you do, because you've spoken to so many businesses, because you've tried and tested so many, you've researched, tried and tested so many things, how do you make that happen? Like, I mean, you've mentioned that don't be a jerk to people, be this, but how do we describe good agency culture?
Yeah, wonderful, rich question. I think that let me go to the point here about what does a culture shift look like? So if we say culture is how we behave and we want to improve our culture, then we need to improve our behaviors. So it's not about the things, right? It's about how we behave. And the way, for example, the way that we teach improved behaviors is we actually coach whole agencies on specific behaviors. In other words, when we're handling scope for the project, how do we do it in a way that lets everyone take ownership and understanding of the scope? Now, most agencies will say, well, our project manager, our account manager, our department leads, they are responsible for scope. And that means everyone else isn't responsible for scope. Right. The minute someone takes responsibility, they take it away from everyone else, right? And what we really want a better culture is when everybody feels like they own the project. And I'm going to come back to your earlier part of your question. is when we're in a, when we're in firefighting mode, when it's a project that's flaming out of fire and it's every, all of us are working to try and figure out what do we need to do next. And we're working as this team that's under incredible stress. It's actually a slightly better moment culture-wise. That's what you're sort of getting at. It's slightly a better moment culture-wise because we're all behaving with each other in a way that we all are taking ownership of the scope and it's all ours and we win as a team and all that kind of thing. So that that shift, it just a vivid demonstration how of the accidental shift of scope ownership that happens in a very, very bad project, right, is the same thing you can engineer on a daily basis in all of your projects, is getting teams feeling like they are completely a part of the project. They take ownership of it. The behavior is we are all one team and this is all of our problems to solve. Creates a very different culture inside the organization.
Yeah, that's a fascinating point. Why does culture matter in helping agencies grow? And how do you maintain it as the organization grows? Because as you know, as you've said, when you move from 10 to 20 to a 50 person organization, as you know, as Jack becomes more and more removed from the team and the team grows, the 50th person in the team doesn't experience culture the same way as the first person that you hired. How do you maintain that? And why does that help in helping agencies grow?
Yeah, and so there's, I'm going to refer to a book that's not mine because there are so many books that are great books that are not mine, sadly. Well, this is called War by Sebastian Junger. It's a military-oriented book, but he talks about group sizes and the like. And it's a great read if you want to understand the group dynamics of culture and the like. The challenge that we have is that this idea of cohesive culture, like I belong to a group of us and we own this thing and that kind of thing, it's a size-limiting concept. In other words, I can feel it with 5 people. I can feel it with 10, 20, like you said. When I get to 50-person group, we naturally as humans, this is a human mechanism, okay? We naturally as humans start, the word I use and commonly use is we start balkanizing. We start breaking into smaller subcultures. So I feel like I belong to a smaller part of the organization. Sometimes it's the unhappy part of the organization, right? Or maybe I'm with the happy, the in-group part of the organization. But I'll start identifying with smaller groups inside of the larger agency. This means I don't have a uniform agency culture, right? And it starts creating in-group, out-group behaviors, which are very toxic to culture as well. So the answer is, when we get big, we have to get small again. The answer is that the 50, 60, especially the 60-person agency needs to become 2 30-person agencies. We call them pods. Right. You need to sort of podify your organization. And in that 30-person group, you can feel that group culture again. It's just, it's called natural group size for humans. And that's why I mentioned the book War by Sebastian Junger. There's a natural group size of about 25 to 35 people, often called the platoon size, right? That size is a perfect size group for people to feel like they belong and trust and are engaged with everyone.
I want to come back to this idea of pods in a moment because that was going to be my next question, and I'm glad you brought that up. There's something else that comes to mind for me as you're talking, which is something that we saw the rise of in the advent of social media, funnily enough, where the groups that we kind of belong to or the tribes that we build, I think at some point then that number was 100. Or something along those lines. And you're mentioning 25 to 30. How are these two different in how we see ourselves in groups or these platoon sizes in an organization versus out in the world, like on social media or these kinds of platforms where we connect with people from anywhere in the world?
Yeah, I think that there's sort of a set of concentric rings, if you will. And the research, I forget his name, but if you ping me afterwards, after this podcast, we can get it as a link into the show notes.
Yeah.
This idea of natural group size is that there are multiple sizes. Like there's the group size around five or so, which I call a natural team. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need, this is what Google does. Back to Google. Google does five-person teams. I saw Jason Fried of 37 Signals the other day posted something that he doesn't use anything more than a three-person team to do anything in the organization. A three-person team needs no managers. It's ultimately efficient. Mm-hmm. So it's a self-managed group. You get up to 15 people. You do need a manager, 15 to 25. And the whole sort of archaeology or structure of how these things work is quite interesting. There's another breakpoint. I think it's around 75, and then there's another one around 150. The 150 one is the one you were speaking of, which is the size of a group that I can feel like I kind of know everyone, okay? And that I actually feel like it's a reputational circle. In other words, by the way, there's all kinds of interesting stuff. I think I mentioned it in one of the podcasts you referenced, or one of the webinars you referenced. It's the use of gossip as an information technique.
Yeah. Okay,
in the 150 person circle, gossip is a very powerful technique because if someone says something about someone else, that's how I manage that circle, right? The 25-person circle is a direct observation circle. I can see everyone. I'm connected with them often enough that I can directly trust and monitor them. And so that it's interesting. Right, it's a lot of it's built around survival, right? All of this goes back to the fact that 400,000 years ago, we had to figure out how to get along and how to survive being with each other.
Yeah, interesting. So you advocate for the introduction of pods in this flattening structure, just to go back to that, which, of course, is how organizations can manage people and can improve how they manage their teams. Can you explain what you mean by pods and share some examples of where they've worked effectively in helping to build agencies?
So when I say pod, what I really say, and I think I mentioned this before, what I really mean is a mini agency within an agency. So, and the number we use really is 25 to 40 people, 25 to 45. I seem to say different numbers slightly every time I talk about this. It's a group, roughly 30 people. So if I'm a 60-person agency, I will run much more efficiently as two 30-person pods. It's not like they're completely separated. They can share resources and support each other and all that kind of thing. So you can think of it as a family organization or something like that. They will help each other out and the like. You don't really lose, you do lose a little bit of flexibility, but you gain way more back in productivity and culture and all those things. So that's the basic concept. I'll give you an example from a Australia agency that I love so much named August. And the CEO, Dan Bannock there, it's about a 30, 40 person agency, a really cool agency. They are just one pod. A lot of agencies are just one pod, but actually, you know, the thing is, do you have the right shape? In other words, if you're big, have you gone small so you have pods? And then the question is, how do we run a pod really well? How do we have those managerial practices and empowerment and all that stuff? And Dan has done such a good job of it that literally they don't have any managers. Well, maybe Dan is a manager in a sense, but he does the business development work. But everyone else just manages. Everyone else manages how the organization runs from a delivery perspective. And he's even gone so far to tie back to one of our earlier discussion points. He's gone so far as to get rid of titles. And he just has, you know, people get paid what they're worth. And people do the work and they team, and everyone objected at first. And Dan and said, well, what do I put on LinkedIn? What do I put on my resume or whatever, that kind of thing?
Yeah.
And Dan said, you can put whatever you want. I don't care.
Yeah, put CEO for what I care.
You just have to live up to it if you leave here, right? And so, so he's gotten rid of the pyramid, okay? He has very, very happy people. It's a beautifully running organization. They all sort of love each other because they're always working together on just getting the stuff done and the like. So pretty amazing how, if you really want to push it to the extreme, you can have an organization that takes very little effort to run and has very high happiness and productivity.
One of the many differences really that I see between the tech industry as well as the creative industry, and tech uses Agile quite a lot. I think that in very many ways, some will say that's where it's kind of borrowed from. One of the things really that happens in tech that doesn't happen as much in agencies is this idea of constant iteration, of experimentation until you get to a prototype or model that kind of works. And I'm guessing one of the pushbacks in the agency model is that you have a client who's got a campaign next week, right? Or something along those lines. How do you bring Agile then and those things that work really well within the tech space, like the pods, like this experimentation, like getting to, like iterating and reiterating on an idea until you get to the perfect one, which is the prototype you use? How do you firstly corral your clients towards that and still use Agile within the agency space where there are so many things, so many clients happening at the same time, like the number of 120, for example, that we used earlier?
Yeah, the answer is you can't. Okay. And that's the, in a sense, it would be a very simple discussion if you could, right? And in a sense, I would not have a business. The business that we made was born out of someone asking me. Originally, I ran Sapient's Los Angeles office, 105-person office, and they asked me to implement Agile there. And they had a very classic software Agile format. And we implemented it. And what it really looked like was everyone did what they normally did before Agile. And then they also did a bunch of Agile rituals on top of it. So everyone just worked harder to act like they were doing Agile, but in fact, it didn't work. And in fact, the thing I love to say is, if you ask the client what the MVP is, the minimum viable product, they will say all of it by November 15th. That's completely non-software agile, right? And so that's the reality. Agencies are in a deadline-driven organization. A very small fraction of your clients, you might be able to move to a non-deadline-driven model, but all of your competitors are offering deadline-driven delivery, right? So what I will tell you is only about 30% of the basic techniques out of software agile work inside of an agency. So then the question is, I'm going to give you an example in a second as well. The question is, what do you do about the rest? if only 30%, what do we fill in with? We can't fill in, because if we're disrupting some things and going to, like you said, to going to team-based structures and collaborative, how do we fill in the rest of the gaps? And that's what we've built over 220 agencies and other organizations. We've built a toolkit that it resembles Agile, but it's not Agile. It's a piece of it. I'll give you a simple example also. There's a thing called Agile planning, and we all know it as a cliche from some sitcoms and the like. It's with the sticky notes on the wall, and everyone, and there's a thing called planning poker where we all argue about how big, in terms of time cost, each of those stickies are and that kind of thing. And that's a beautiful exercise in software Agile because everyone is a programmer. And so they can argue about Fibonacci numbers. Is it 5 or is it 8 or is it 11? And they'll do this whole little, or 13, I guess. They'll do this whole discussion and they'll agree it's an 8. Now, in an agency, that same discussion is impossible because I've got a social media person, I've got a technologist, I've got a creative, I've got a user experience designer. They're all looking at that same sticky note. And they all have different numbers, and all of their numbers are correct. Okay. because the social media person is, well, that's a lot of work for me. The technologist is, hey, that's, they'll just take me a minute. Creative is like, well, I don't know. I need to think about that. And all them, there's no fusion. It isn't like we can agree on a number. So the whole idea, this is a key activity in Software Agile. This whole idea just goes out the window. And so then the question is, how do you get a team to plan the work together? You need a new way of doing it. And so, for example, we reinvented a way for agencies to do collaborative planning around the work.
Mm-hmm. In some of our conversations that I've had with agency owners, big and small, this idea of wastage in agencies comes up a lot. How do they make improvements using some of these, you know, some of the models that you've spoken about?
Could you define wastage for me, just so I'm sure I'm talking about the same thing?
So I think I mean, one of those things is spending too much time on tasks that they shouldn't be spending so much time on, for example, because time is money to them, or committing too many of their resources on a project that pays too little because a client calls for it. And if you are a smaller agency, that happens to you quite a lot because you're trying to service this bigger client so that you have them as part of your portfolio.
Yeah. So the term I usually use, and there are a couple terms that I've heard, and I've never heard that one. So thank you. Now I add that to my my glossary of synonyms and the like. A term very commonly also used is rework rate, is how much, and that would be, or overage rate. In other words, we thought we were going to spend 500 hours on this, but we spent 700 hours on it, right? And that 200 extra hours is the overage rate or rework rate, and certainly a wastage as well, right? The main drivers for that are the fact that we don't understand scope as well as we think we do. We don't hand it off to the team very well, and we don't get aligned with the client on what scope is. So we end up aligning through failure. In other words, we kind of think we knew what it was, so we're going to build something, show it to the client. The client says, no, that's not it. I didn't even understand what you asked me, what I really want, and we iterate over and over and over. So that's the... When you fix that cycle of not starting work before you understand it very well, and also not starting work until you're sure that you and the client understand the work, or at least its challenges, when you fix that, you can drop what is in the industry average for this rate, by the way, is 25 to 40%. That is, on average, a 1,000-hour project comes in at 1,250 to 1,400 hours worth of cost. That's expensive, especially when you're small. And if you master how to handle scope and context for the work and the client correctly, you can slash that dramatically by 80%. And you can literally drop hundreds of thousands of dollars to your bottom line, or increase the capacity of your organization by just not spending so much, if you will, wasted time.
If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show.
So just to delve a bit more into the book now. So your book, Unmanaged, the Mass... exactly, that one.
You're working on Amazon.
Unmanaged, Master the Magic of Creating Empowered and Happy Organizations, draws from over a decade of research with over 200 agencies and organizations. What are the most common pitfalls that you find in agencies, and how do they empower managers and managing in general? You touched on it a bit earlier, but what are the most sort of common pitfalls that you find?
I think there are a couple things. One is, there's a thing I call the multi-multi myth. And this is the idea that if we having a multi-project environment and multiple managers and multi-allocated people somehow is efficient. It's not. In fact, the confluence of those three things, in fact, drives efficiency down dramatically. And I'll just dig into one, but I could dig into every single one of them. They're all in the book. But one is multi-allocation. if I think about it, I've got Jonathan who this week he's going to work on, you know, 11 different projects. And one of them he's working 15 hours on. We've got him assigned. We've allocated him, right? 15 hours on one project, 10 hours on another project. Let's see, I've got 15 hours, maybe 3 or 4 hours on a couple projects. And then there are a couple other projects that an hour here, hour there, that kind of thing. And so he's got this sort of long tail of work. And what does Jonathan get done that week? Probably the big project, maybe most of the second one. Okay. And probably none of the other ones, or maybe he touches them or something like that. Yet he gets underutilized by how fragmented he is, because there's a cost to having to even keep in your mind the many things you need to do, not to mention that all the managers for all those pieces of work are going to be constantly bothering Jonathan, when are you going to work on my work, which keeps Jonathan from doing any work at all. Right. And so there's this very toxic, I call it the multi environment. And agencies don't realize that's costly. I'm going to throw one last point in here. And that is that if I'm 5 people or 10 people, there aren't that many multis to multiply, right? When I get to 50 people, I usually have 15 managers, like we said, 40 clients, 120 projects. And so the fragmentation grows quite large at that point.
You mentioned earlier that at times agencies promote sort of the best working person to become a manager without necessarily training them. And you outlined a little bit around, you know, what the pitfalls of that are or where things go wrong there. In the book, you talk about how our management models are mostly based on a factory mindset, and you introduce this approach that you refer to as flow. Can you share what you mean by flow and how it works in the creative industry?
Yeah, it's a great question following what we just spoke of. So productive flow is the time at which someone who is a maker, a worker, has time to actually do the work by focusing on it. And we know from researchers like Cal Newport, who has a new book out, which is a pretty cool book, and a lot of other great research, that if in fact someone doesn't have blocks of time, in other words, uninterrupted time for a half hour, an hour, that kind of thing, to get deep work done, they can't get it done. They keep on getting interrupted and they keep on becoming less efficient. So when we measure, this is really interesting stats, the beauty of having worked with so many agencies and other sort of development and project-driven organizations is we have these numbers. And one of these numbers is when you go to a 50-person agency and ask the workers, how much productive flow do you get every day? How many hours? The number typically is 2.5 hours. Okay, think about that. I'm paying this person 8 hours a day. And I know they won't get 8 hours of productivity. But do you imagine as a CEO that you're only getting 2.5 hours of productivity? No. Being busy is not the same as being productive, right? And so the question is, if you're in this multi environment and you make it better, how much better can it get? And the reality is, even in the best, you know, I would say, well, again, someone like August, they're probably getting 6 hours, okay, 5 or 6 hours, the agency August I mentioned. A lot of the agencies we work with get up to 4, 4.5 hours. It still sounds like a bit of a tragedy, but realize they were coming from 2.5. So if I can get to 4 hours, that's like a 50% boost in productive time during the day. That's an amazing boost, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a huge challenge inside of agencies. It's invisible. You don't see it if you're a manager because you're actually part of the problem.
Yeah, that's quite the indictment there on managers. Jack, we usually ask our guests to leave a question for our next guest, and the last guest that I spoke to is the CMO of Investec, and he left a question for you, and it's going to be a bit of a long-ish one, but the essence is pretty clear. So I'm going to try read it without butchering it too much. So how often do you look at the core of your brand and assess whether or not you're effectively amplifying that core of the brand through everything that you do? When was the last time that you went back and looked at the core or the essence of your brand and the key of sort of what makes the brand, right? So in essence, when last did you really have a deep dive of what the brand stands for and how successfully and well you amplify what it really stands for?
Well, I'm gonna answer it, but first I want to say I'm giving you an A+ on your questions today. Not only have you come up with original questions, which are deeply insightful, but also you'll see why when I answer the question, maybe even more than an A+. So thank you very much. It's been wonderful. Just a real pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks.
Right after this recording, I'm meeting with an executive creative director strategist to talk about our rebranding project, which includes all of those things. And it's been a work in progress for several years now, but in fact, it is literally job one for me these days. And we're moving to a new brand. It may be out in the wild by the time this podcast airs. I'm not sure how long it takes, but it's called Better Company, because that's what at the end of the day we do, is we help companies become better companies. We help people become better company with each other. In other words, accompanying each other and the like on the journey. As a CEO of the organization, I think it's so hard to keep your eye on, but also it's one of those things it's essential to keep your eye on and the like. So wonderful question.
That's great. So if you could leave a question for our next guest, depending on who that guest is, what is the one question that you would want us to ask them?
I'm going to stick in the unmanaged vein here. I'm going to say, what is the one thing that you have learned about managing and management over the years that they don't teach in books, that people don't realize? In other words, what is it that makes for great counterintuitive managing? And how has that been manifested in your behavior and your organization?
That's an amazing question. Yeah. No, that's an amazing question, because it talks to what you learn on the job, as it were, right? And through people and through the people you interact and engage with. And it can change depending on the type of organization that you are leading or managing. So that's a great question. And the last one for you, Jack, if you could ask any living person about their unique take on marketing, life, creativity, or even management, which is what we've spoken about, who would that person be, and what is the one question that you would ask them?
You know, I probably a little bit stumped. Actually, the guy who I probably would have been, most of the guys that I would ask are actually dead now, and Daniel Kahneman, the author of Thinking Fast and Slow, an amazing psychologist, also thought of as an economist, Nobel Prize winner, I would have spoken to him, and so I'm just going to cheat and use that. And ask him, because he never talked about it specifically, is what is it that we don't understand about managing that you've learned through what you've done with all the psychological behavioral research, which is now called behavioral economics and the like? If you had to sum up, what's the single most important takeaway in behavioral economics about managing? What is that? I would ask him that question. Absolutely. And I would try to do it like over a nice meal so I could drag out the answer for a couple hours.
Yeah. That's a really great question. And I think someone I would ask a question like that actually would be of the people that I've kind of spoken to and people whose thinking I follow would be someone like Rory Sutherland, because in sort of behavioral economics, not only that, but also how does he manage teams to kind of translate some of the ideas that he shares? So that's an amazing question. Jack, thank you so much for making the time. I really love your work, and I'll keep following.
Thank you very much. Wonderful interview. I just like really, really fun and mind-bendingly awesome in terms of you asking great questions. Thank you for the depth of your research as well. I appreciate it.
No, thank you. Thanks so much.
You too.
Have a great one, Jack.
Thank you for listening to The Lead Creative. Did you get one insight that's worth sharing from this episode? Please share it with your network or your friends. Pop me some of your ideas and innovative finds on Twitter on @Mongezi. This podcast is available on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find me on mongezi.com.